Hey, it's Jen. Just a quick heads up before we start the show. The news is rapidly developing, and things may have changed by the time you hear this episode. For the very latest news, tune into your public radio station and follow updates at npr.org.
This is 1A. I'm Todd Zwillick of Vice News in Washington. I'm in for Jen White today. It's time for the news roundup. 1 year ago this week, Dr. Anthony Fauci of NIH had a dire prediction when he testified in front of Congress.
Things will get worse than they are right now. How much worse we'll get will depend on our ability to do two things: to contain the influx of people who are infected coming from the outside, and the ability to contain and mitigate within our own country. Bottom line, it's going to get worse.
After a full year of this coronavirus pandemic, President Joe Biden had a different kind of prediction to share.
By July the 4th, there's a good chance you, your families and friends will be able to get together in your backyard or in your neighborhood and have a cookout or a barbecue and celebrate Independence Day. That doesn't mean large events with lots of people together, but it does mean small groups will be able to get together. After this long, hard year, that will make this Independence Day something truly special, where we not only mark our independence as a nation, but we begin to mark our independence from this virus.
Well, is that presidential optimism a presidential risk? Let's get into it. Anita Kumar is White House correspondent and associate editor with Politico. Anita, good to talk to you again.
Thanks for having me back.
And David Lightman is here, congressional correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers. David, great to talk to you as well.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And Julie Rovner is here. Julie is chief Washington correspondent with Kaiser Health News. She's also host of the podcast, What the Health? Julie, great to see you.
Thanks, Todd.
Well, President Biden delivered his first national televised address last night. You just heard a clip of it. It marked 1 year since the WHO declared COVID-19 a global pandemic. And he used that time in prime time to announce an ambitious new goal.
All adult Americans will be eligible to get a vaccine no later than May 1. That's much earlier than expected. Let me be clear. That doesn't mean everyone's going to have that shot immediately, but it means you'll be able to get in line beginning May 1. Every adult will be eligible to get their shot.
Anita, this is a much more ambitious timeline than we heard even a few weeks ago from President Biden. How is the White House going to make this happen, this promise of enough vaccine for every adult by May?
Yeah, I mean, it's really striking what he said, because there are a lot of people who thought he was being too cautious these last few weeks, the first few weeks of his presidency, that he was talking about goals that were already being reached, or that he should, you know, that he should stretch it a little bit more. And he really did put these numbers and these dates out there. You know, I think he's feeling somewhat confident with the number of vaccines. You know, I know we'll get into this a little bit later, but they've actually talking about ordering vaccines. The number, it's going to exceed the number of adults in the United States, or the number of people in the United States that need it. You know, they're already facing some criticism. Why is the president securing this many vaccines when we probably won't need it? So, you know, I think that he's feeling confident now with these three different vaccines that are coming forward. You know, I will say that before he spoke, the White House and staff, you know, made sure to say, look, there are some things that could come along here, and that we may not reach these goals if these variants come about, if there's some other problems that come. So they were still being somewhat cautious, but clearly to name these dates, May 1st and July 4th, they must feel pretty confident in the vaccine.
Setting benchmarks for the future. Maybe there's an opportunity for some vaccine diplomacy if the United States is going to have a surplus. But Julie, what has to happen on the vaccine side, on the distribution side, on the equity side, for this May 1st goal to be reached for Americans?
Well, I think the administration feels pretty
confident, interestingly, on the equity side, because they can do things like get mobile vaccine, you know, vans out and give more vaccine to community health centers that serve sort of populations that are both low income and are in shortages of health providers. I think the bigger problem for this May 1st deadline is that a lot of states, including my own home state of Maryland, are just don't have enough capacity to deliver all of those vaccines. That here in Maryland, we haven't even made high-risk people eligible, you know, who are in their 60s. I happen to be one of them. So the idea that, you know, in just 6 weeks, everybody's going to be eligible and it's going to be that much harder to get an appointment. I think, you know, in the states, and there are a number of them where it is still really, there are way more arms chasing vaccines than there are vaccines. That's going to be interesting to see. But I do think they are pretty confident about how they're going to get to the vaccine hesitant and to the people who have difficulty getting to vaccines. I think it's just sort of the large masses. We'll see how long it takes to actually, you know, get these shots in arms and whether they'll have enough vaccinators.
David, that speech last night from the president, his first national primetime speech, was heavy on symbolism 1 year into the pandemic. It was heavy on empathy, which is sort of the Biden brand, talking about what we've lost, taking out that card that he carries in his pocket with the latest number of American dead written on it. What is this moment for the White House as they try to shepherd the country through the pandemic?
Well, he has to show that he knows what he's doing. That Joe Biden is well-known in Washington, well-known as a senator, and well-known as competent in certain areas. I mean, judiciary, foreign affairs, et cetera. So I think what he had to do last night is convey that to people. I know what I'm doing. I'm not just a Washington creature, but I know how to do this. And it's interesting how he used not vague language, but somewhat couched language. In the clip you played, for example, there's a good chance that on July 4th, he's not saying you will be able to have these cookouts July 4th. And I think if you go through the speech, there is a lot of that fuzziness, if you will. And that's the mark of somebody, again, who is trying to show, I know what I'm doing. I'm not making you crazy promises, but I'm pretty confident. I know the system. And if things work out, we'll be okay.
We're speaking with Politico's Anita Kumar, David Lightman of McClatchy, and Julie Robner of Kaiser Health News. The CDC came out with guidance last week that vaccinated people could safely gather indoors with low-risk people 2 weeks after their final shot, small groups. But the agency is still discouraging traveling. Now, Dr. Lena Wen, an emergency physician and visiting professor at George Washington University, said this week on CNN that she disagreed with that guidance on travel.
This is one of these examples where I think the CDC is being far overly cautious in a way that defies common sense. Because look at what they're saying about quarantine. So they're saying that if somebody knowingly is exposed to an individual with COVID-19 and they're fully vaccinated, they don't need to test or get quarantined. If you're sitting on a plane, you're not necessarily sitting next to people with COVID-19. You're wearing a mask. Ideally, you're keeping distanced. And so it just doesn't make sense that you can't travel, especially if you now can get together with loved ones.
Julie, I'm glad you're here because for so long you've had one foot in healthcare and one foot in politics, and that's where the CDC is now.
The CDC is walking such a tightrope on this. They want to tell people that once they're vaccinated and presumably immune or virtually immune after those 2 weeks have passed since the last shot, they can get back to some semblance of normal. On the other hand, we're still only up around 10 or 12% of the population that's been vaccinated. So you have a lot of vulnerable people still out there, and they don't want to tell vaccinated people that they can open things up and go out and do things for concern about all those people who are not yet vaccinated. And CDC Director Rochelle Walensky was very careful to say this is a first cut at this. When there are more people vaccinated, we'll change some of these guidelines. It's really hard. I mean, they want this to be an enticement for people to get vaccinated by letting them do more things, but they don't want everything to open, which is what some of these governors are doing. They're just saying, okay, let's open everything up.
And I want to ask you about that, Anita, because the president is saying still wear that mask. Do it for yourself. Do it for your family. Do it for your friends. Do it for your country. We can get through this together. Wear the masks. Well, in Texas, the governor, as Julie mentioned, Greg Abbott, has announced he's lifting all restrictions. Mississippi's done it as well. The city of Austin says they're keeping the mask mandate, and it's a huge, almost predictable controversy in Texas. Anita, how's the White House handling its message when governors, especially Republican governors, are going in the opposite direction?
Yeah, I mean, you're exactly right. It's not just Texas. Some states never had the mask mandate to begin with. So it's at least 16 states don't have one at this point. You know, they're really limited at what they can do. You know, there are people who say, well, why can't they just order them, order the states to have people wear masks? And it's just not possible. That's just not allowed in the law. So really, the president has a couple options. One is to sort of threaten the states and say, look, I'm going to withhold something if you don't have these mask mandates. This is something President Trump tried, not with mask mandates, but just in general on a variety of things, including reopenings. He wanted people to reopen, if you'll remember last year. That just doesn't get you very far. And, you know, what is President Biden going to say? I won't give you the vaccine if you don't have these mandates. That's just not going to happen. So his only option at this point is the bully pulpit, is he can go out like he did last night, travel the country, speak about the importance of this, that you're doing it for yourself, but you're also doing it for other people, and why this is important and what's behind it and what the science says. And you're going to see him continue to do this. And he has been pretty critical of some of these states, and he hasn't shied away from using tough language on these states and these governors. And I think you'll continue to see him do that. He told Americans that he wanted them to wear their masks for 100 days. Let's get through this. And he's going to continue to do that.
You're going to be seeing a lot more of the president and White House officials in the coming week as they try to sell the merits of the COVID relief package. But part of the question there is, can the president, can the first lady convince Americans who've already decided about masks? Can he win over the governor of Texas? Probably not. It's the News Roundup. We're discussing the week's biggest headlines. We'll have more from you and from our guests in a moment.
Support for 1A and the following message come from The Jab, a new podcast from The Economist. How well will COVID-19 vaccines work, and what do they mean for life going forward? What are vaccine passports, and will you need one? Find the answers in The Jab. Each week, The Economist science correspondent Alok Jha and their health policy editor Natasha Loader unpack a different theme and talk through the race between infections and injections. Subscribe and listen to The Jab for free today on Apple Podcasts, Acast, or your podcast app.
On NPR's Consider This podcast, we help you make sense of one big story in the news every day, like how to combat disinformation and conspiracy theories, which pose a real threat to democracy, and what life looks like after you're vaccinated, the next phase of do's and don'ts. All that in 15 minutes every weekday. Listen now to Consider This from NPR.
It's the News Roundup. We're discussing the week's biggest news. Let's jump back into the conversation. And we got this question, speaking of vaccines, which we were just before the break. David, this is a great question from Mike, who's a frequent commenter here on the show, but it's a good one. Biden's inauguration speech focused on unity. Last night, President Biden gave Donald Trump no credit for Operation Warp Speed and all of the vaccines that we've gotten from it. Did President Biden miss an opportunity to work toward unity, David?
The answer is yes. I mean, Operation Warp Speed did begin under the Trump administration. And whatever else you can criticize that administration for, it did begin there, was pushed and prodded there. Biden made an attempt at unity, although when you had 10 Republicans who proposed an alternative to the $1.9 trillion rescue plan that was signed into law yesterday, and nobody believed that that Republican plan would go anywhere. It was too small. It was too rigid. And the feeling was that Biden was paying lip service to these Republicans. He said, you know, he wanted bipartisanship, but there really was very little attempt at that. I have to say, though, for context, that's not all that unusual. I mean, you go back to Bill Clinton in 1993 with his economic relief plan, and there was virtually no Republican support for that plan. So these opening drives the presidents have done the last 30 years tend to be pretty much partisan. Go back to Obama, George W. Bush's tax cut and so forth. The question is now, can he work with Republicans on other matters? And we can get into that later, I suppose.
And maybe the question in history for a lot of Democrats now, I'll tell you this, is all that bipartisanship we tried for with Obamacare, was it worth it? Did it get us anywhere? Did it really pay off? I think the Biden people are asking themselves that question. We may be getting an answer also. Anita, let's talk about this $1.9 trillion bill. It's gigantic. It's the second largest spending bill in the history of the country. So we've heard about direct checks. We've heard about the billions for vaccines and distribution. But why is this bill so big? It seems like there's a lot more going on here than just COVID.
You sound like the Republicans on Capitol Hill. That's exactly what they're arguing. They're saying, look, you can argue that money should be spent on coronavirus, and they disagree on what that should be exactly, but they're calling this a Democratic wish list of other issues that really don't have a direct impact on coronavirus. So those are changes to the child care tax credit. Those are, it was the minimum wage, which they removed. So they're saying, look, why are you putting so many other things in this bill? They're also worried, of course, about the size of the bill and what's going to happen when, some of these programs, they're funding now, but when the money is gone for that, how is that going to continue in the future? Are Democratic lawmakers just going to come back and say, well, we have to continue these now and have another bill for that? So you're exactly right. There are things that are related, like testing and vaccines, and there are things that are not related but could help push Americans back up. So they're really looking at this as a bill that will bring other people out of poverty, push those low-income and middle-income Americans up while this coronavirus is going on.
And let's talk about how far this bill has reached to do that, David. We talk about the direct checks, $1,400 for most families going out soon. I've read as soon as this weekend in some cases, especially if you have direct deposit. But what about the tax credits in this bill targeting child poverty? What about the money for parents, working parents with kids? Even Speaker Nancy Pelosi has made the point, she's not hiding the ball. They intended for this to be transformative.
Yeah, I mean, the argument Democrats make is that it's COVID-related because COVID devastated the economy and you need this to sustain that. There's a feeling among Democrats that when President Obama offered a relief or got a relief plan passed back in 2009, it wasn't enough and the economy sputtered for years. Again, economists will debate that until the end of time. But in this bill, you do have some significant steps here aimed at reducing poverty, particularly child poverty. The child tax credit, beginning in July, families with children 6 to 17 who qualify will get monthly payments of $250 a month. If the child's under 6, $300 a month. As Anita was pointing out, though, that program ends at the end of the year, and chances are Democrats will want to continue it. So there's some significant anti-poverty programs there. The question is this going to overheat the economy? Is it needed? Should a family of four earning $140,000 get $5,600 in stimulus checks, which is what they'll be getting? Again, we could debate this all day. It's going to be fascinating to see.
Now, Julie, we talk about the COVID relief bill. We talk about health care because that's COVID. But there were plenty of health care provisions in this bill that really don't have much to do with shots and distribution. There were provisions on Obamacare and a lot of other stuff, too.
That's right. Well, they are connected to COVID in that the Democrats say that it is obviously suboptimal to still have 28 million people without health insurance during a global pandemic. But there are indeed some really big increases to health care. Again, they are temporary. The Affordable Care Act is expanding its subsidies both at the high end and the low end. So people who currently aren't eligible for any subsidies will start to get help, probably a lot of help. There'll be the amount they'll have to pay for premiums is capped at 8.5% of income. At the lower end, people up to 1.5 times poverty will be guaranteed a zero premium mid-level plan. There is some enticement for the 12 holdout states to expand Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act. That includes some big states like Texas and Florida and Georgia. May not be enough, but it's there. And they'll also tucked into this bill, they will pay people's COBRA premiums. If they get laid off or lose enough hours to lose their health insurance, they can keep their employer-based coverage. And most people can't do it because the premiums are so enormous, you have to pay the whole amount. This bill will pay 100% of those COBRA premiums through September.
So those are big benefits for people, maybe even if they're already vaccinated or even if they're not in the middle or the lower end of the income stream. I want to talk a little bit about how this bill passed Congress and what it tells us about Congress in this moment. We talk about a lack of bipartisanship all the time. And as I mentioned, this COVID relief bill passed without a single Republican vote, not one Republican vote, even though 70% of the American public say they support it. Now, Democratic Congressman Tim Ryan is from Ohio, and he got on the House floor to talk about working in a Congress that sometimes seems like it's on different planets.
We talk about pensions, you complain. We talk about the minimum wage increase, you complain. We talk about giving them the right to organize, you complain. But if we were passing a tax cut here, you'd be all getting in line to vote yes for it. Now stop talking about Dr. Seuss and start working with us on behalf of the American workers.
David Lightman, not one Republican vote for this bill. Republicans spent a lot of this debate not talking about stimulus or how to get out of the pandemic or how much to spend on that vaccine. But as Congressman Ryan said, a lot of time talking about Dr. Seuss and the culture wars, cancel culture. What does this tell us about where Republicans are now?
Well, first of all, it's not that unusual to have a heavily partisan vote, as I said, at the beginning of a term or even on a major initiative. The 2017 Republican tax cut plan, as I recall, no Democrat voted for that. And again, go back to Obama's economic stimulus in 2009 or Clinton in 93, et cetera. What's different, though, is the level of anger. In the past, if you look back, yeah, Clinton had to use only Democrats to pass his economic plan. But 11 months later, North American Free Trade Agreement passes with Republican and Democratic votes. Bush in 2000 got his tax cut plan through, but then got No Child Left Behind, the education reform. I'm not sure Biden can do that. I mean, his initiatives now, infrastructure, immigration, there's very little Republican support for that. And part of it is fueled by this anger that each side feels about the other. And part of that was exacerbated by the January 6th insurrection. Each side somehow, Democrats somehow feeling Republicans, maybe not complicit is the word, but somehow weren't tough enough. They didn't like the votes they took to overturn the election. So it's going to take a while for that bitterness to evaporate.
Anita, David sees a Congress where each side has suspicions and anger toward the other side. And I do agree with that, but I see something slightly different. I see a Republican opposition now with a base that doesn't believe that Democratic governance, capital D, is legitimate, that they've been conditioned for years and certainly for the last 4 years to believe that a Democratic government just isn't legitimate. Why in the world would they shake hands with it?
Yeah, no, I definitely agree with that. I mean, that's part of the Republican Party anyway, and you see that because people, they don't actually believe what's being said on the other side. And I know we talk a lot about how, oh, there's not bipartisanship. I mean, we, as David just pointed out, there's been lots of times that the other side hasn't voted for a bill. It really does feel different since November. It felt different during President Trump's term, but it really does feel different these last few months. There's the anger, and there's also that each side doesn't believe the other side. So it's hard to understand how they're going to sit down and come up with a compromise on anything when this is where they are. You know, one of the things that really has struck me from the last couple months that every time I think about this bipartisanship, I think this is why they can't do anything. Something the House Speaker said, Nancy Pelosi, when she said, the enemy is within, she meant within the House, that she's talking about Republicans. And it's hard to see how they're going to sit down and work together when she says something like that.
It's also hard to see how you have, frankly, a president who spends years and years concertedly undermining faith in democracy, faith in elections to preserve his own political capital, and then turn around and expect the people on that president's coattails to believe in governance, believe in democracy, and cooperate with their colleagues. Well, speaking of getting along in Congress, Yesterday, here on 1A, we spoke to Democratic Senator Michael Bennett of Colorado, who had this to say about the Senate and about how Congress can function in this political culture when the Senate still has a filibuster.
Jen, I've never seen the filibuster. I've been here now 11 years. It's hard to believe. I've never seen the filibuster used to get to a bipartisan result.
Anita, the reason this $1.9 trillion COVID relief bill passed is because they use special budgetary rules where there is no filibuster. You don't need 60 votes. Now, you can't do that very often, and you can't use it for most big things. Seems like Senator Bennett knows that. We're getting closer, it seems, to louder rumblings, especially among Democrats, to maybe do away with the filibuster altogether. What are you hearing?
Definitely hearing that. And when you talk to House Democrats, they are so eager for it to be gone. I've talked to so many House Democrats who are pushing for immigration or firearms restrictions. You name it. They say, why should we have to work this way? Of course, they don't get a choice. They don't have a vote in this. So you're also seeing the White House, though. You're seeing the president saying that he was in the Senate for over three decades and he thinks it should stay. I don't know that there is enough of a push at the moment to change it. But as Democrats face the idea that all of these proposals and policies that they have been wanting to push are coming out of the House and they're just not going anywhere in the Senate, I think it's only going to get, it's only going to get people more supportive of that idea.
Well, universal background checks, firearms legislation passed the House just yesterday, broad public support for that. $15 minimum wage is something that Democrats want. Immigration reform is something they want. David, you've been around the Senate for an awful long time. What could be, if there is one, a tipping point on this filibuster rule in the Senate? What might push wavering or more conservative Democrats to consider this?
Boy, that's a great question. Possibly immigration, because people remember 8 years ago, you had the Gang of Eight. Senator Bennett's been a leader in that the immigration effort. They worked with Senators Rubio, Graham on the Republican side, came up with a bill, passed the Senate with, I think, 70 votes, and died in the House. And they feel the momentum is back for that, a very similar bill. But Senator Graham has said, forget it. I'm not going to do a big comprehensive bill. Senator Rubio is unenthusiastic. It's going to have to be Democrats. That may be a tipping point. But here's the other thing. A lot of the older Democrats, senior Democrats, realize that if you do this, you're kicking the door open to the day Republicans may control the Senate. Now, think about the Democrats were the ones who initiated the 51 votes for judges, right, in 2014-15. Well, that led to 51 votes for Supreme Court nominees, and here we are with three Trump nominees who may not have gotten confirmed if they still needed 60. So they have to think longer range. So I don't think, as Anita said, I think momentum's growing, but it's going to be very slow, and I think it's not going to happen for a while. Immigration could be the tipping point, but 50-50 that it will be.
Julie, David mentions immigration. That's possible. I think that voting rights is something really to watch for Democrats. In state after Republican state, you see voter suppression efforts. They're not new, but ever since Republicans lost the election, into overdrive. And a lot of Democrats are telling other Democrats, if we don't pass federal voting reform, Federal Voting Rights Act, John Lewis Voting Rights in H.R. 1, we're just inviting voter suppression for the next decade. You've been in the Senate long enough. What do you think?
Yeah, I think you're exactly right that if this is going to tip, it's going to tip on the voting bill. But I also think, you know, people talk about getting rid of the filibuster as a, you know, on-off switch. There's a lot of growing support for reforming the filibuster. Right now, in order to have a filibuster in the Senate, basically one senator has to say, yeah, I don't like this, and bang, you need 60 votes. Well, Senator Manchin, who says he doesn't want to get rid of it, is talking about reform, about making them actually put their mouth where their thoughts are and go stand on the floor. Everybody who's seen Mr. Smith come to Washington, and if you want to filibuster a bill, you're going to have to actually physically filibuster the bill. That could be a big difference right there, and particularly on something like voting rights, where it would be uncomfortable for Republicans to say, yeah, we don't want to make it easier for people to vote.
And maybe uncomfortable for Democrats to tell some of their very important constituencies, not just voters of color, but Democrats all over the map, that they've won an election, they've won the presidency, they control the Senate, and they're not going to use maximal power to secure voting rights for people in states like Georgia, Texas, all across the country. Democrats have to worry about their left, too. We'll hear more from you and from our guests in just a moment.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, Hint, fruit-infused water with no calories or sweeteners. Hint water comes in over 25 flavors. The watermelon water actually tastes like watermelon. The blackberry water tastes like blackberries. Hint is water with a touch of true fruit flavor. You can get Hint water at stores, or you can have it delivered directly to your door. When you buy two cases, you'll get a third case free and free shipping. Visit drinkhint.com and use promo code NPR at checkout.
Hearing loss is a fact of life for many humans, but not for fish, reptiles, or birds.
People noticed in chickens that they could take them to, say, a heavy metal concert, blast the ears really to oblivion, and then within days, new hair cells would begin to sprout.
The science of sound. That's next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
You're listening to the News Roundup. We're wrapping up the week's top stories. Before we jump back into politics, a note that the fallout continues from Oprah's bombshell interview with Meghan Markle and Prince Harry. More than 17.1 million people tuned in. In the days since, Piers Morgan has lost his job. The Royal Palace has apologized, and viewers are more divided than ever on the prince and the princess. Now, David Lightman of McClatchy wanted to talk about the royals for the whole hour. I told him we just can't do that, so we're just going to have to make it a small part of the show. But if you're looking for more analysis about that interview, we spent an entire hour on it earlier this week, and you can find that conversation on the website at the1a.org. Well, I want to talk about some of the key cabinet officials starting their jobs in the Biden administration this week. But another former cabinet official made some news yesterday through our very own Vice News DC Bureau. Former acting Defense Secretary Christopher Miller told Vice on Showtime that his boss, Donald Trump, was to blame for the Capitol insurrection on January 6th. You can watch that full interview on Vice on Showtime Sunday at 8 p.m. But Anita, you covered the Trump White House. What did you make of that news?
Yeah, it's interesting. We've seen a number of Republicans and people that worked for Donald Trump say that they felt that he was to blame. Obviously, the secretary is a very high-ranking person. I heard from a lot of people who felt that he was to blame, or at least partially to blame, for what happened. You know, but we also saw people who said in the moment that he was to blame and then sort of backed off of it, right? We saw people, particularly in Capitol Hill, like the Republican leaders both in the Senate and the House, saying he was to blame, but then sort of backing off of it, talking, you know, Kevin McCarthy, the leader, Republican leader in the House, then going down to Mar-a-Lago to meet with President Trump. You know, Senate minority leader, Mitch McConnell, not voting for impeachment. So we've seen that, we've heard that, and then Republicans, some of them anyway, seem to back off of that.
David, some people see the former acting defense secretary as a career person in the Pentagon who, as he says in the interview, endured a political climate under Trump of unethical and potentially illegal orders coming from the White House. Other people see somebody trying to salvage their reputation after working as a very, very senior member of the Trump cabinet on the day of the insurrection.
Yeah, it depends, you know, whose side you're on this thing. It's interesting that there's still a lot of talk and concern about January 6th, but the talk has shifted. You hear very little anymore about whether the President Trump is to blame, and more about law enforcement, who there dropped the ball, why wasn't there better intelligence, what could have been done. In other words, that it's sort of digging deeper now into what the heck, how in the world did this happen? I mean, as you know, you go into the Capitol now and, you know, your belt goes off and two officers surround you. And so how in the world were people able to break the glass and get into the rotunda? That's what people are focusing on now. And so you have less talk about Mr. Miller, President Trump, and more on that.
Which leads us directly to Merrick Garland, the new attorney general, who was confirmed out of the Senate with 70 votes, including Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, who, as we all remember, blocked Garland's nomination to the U.S. Supreme Court back in 2016, didn't even get a hearing. But what you're describing, David, looking at law enforcement, how did it happen? Where was the intelligence? Where was the National Guard? Accountability going forward. Most of this, if not all of it, falls squarely in the lap of the brand new attorney general as he moves into his office today.
Yeah, and there's a great deal of trust in Merrick Garland on both sides, by the way, that, you know, he knows he has a sterling reputation as a judge, as a one-time prosecutor. So the feeling is they're in good hands with him and what he's going to find out. The other bit of drama, though, is what happens with the Capitol Police. I mean, they're going to search for a new police chief. They want 800-some new officers, which would apparently take years to hire. Who's going to protect the Capitol? How's it going to happen? Is that fence going to stay up? Do you need the National Guard? Will tourists be able to return? And all vexing questions, and they're being posed daily, and there are just no good answers yet.
Anita, we learned just this week, in fact, a couple of days ago, that the National Guard will remain on Capitol Hill behind the fences, behind the razor wire, until at least, the third week of May, 2,300 National Guard troops from all over America. It's an extraordinary thing. It's an extraordinary legacy of what this insurrection has left us with, not just the people who died there, not just the horrible insult to democracy, but the ongoing military commitment on the grounds of our legislature.
Yeah, there were so many people, myself included, that thought, you know, a couple days or a couple weeks after January 6th, certainly after the inauguration of on January 20th, that this would all go back to normal. It's not just the Capitol. This fencing is around the White House, and it's just not going away, you know. And we've begun to talk about, well, is this the new normal, right? This militarization, basically, of Washington, D.C., primarily the Capitol, also the White House. I mean, we just don't have any sense that this is going to go away. Some of the ongoing threats remain, though, obviously, and that's why they're there, right? For different gatherings, there's talk that there's a threat for when and if, we haven't heard any details yet, President Biden addresses Congress, of course, during the coronavirus. We don't really know what that's going to look like, but there's also a threat for that. And because there's no timing on that, we just don't know when this is going to end.
We talked about Merrick Garland, the brand new attorney general. I want to make sure we talk about the brand new Secretary of Housing and Urban Development. Her name is Marcia Fudge, longtime congresswoman who's just taken a position in the Biden cabinet. David, we don't spend enough time talking about housing and urban development and their mission. Marcia Fudge inherits this agency from Ben Carson. What's on her plate?
Well, it's funny you talk about that because I was talking to some of our reporters out in California about the money that's in the COVID relief bill for housing. And for example, there's a big chunk of money to help the homeless, which is a growing problem, particularly on the West Coast and in warmer climates. And I think that will be a huge priority for Secretary Fudge. The other is simply helping people with rental assistance. There was money in the COVID relief bills last year. There's some this year. But this is a big problem. People cannot afford to stay in their homes, and she's going to have to not just come up with money, but ways to get people both working, making enough money so they can afford these homes. In other words, some kind of smooth transition from using the COVID money to being self-sufficient. So she's got quite a bit there that she needs to do.
Now, in another corner of the cabinet sits Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas, who is confronting what many people say is a crisis now at the southern border. Mayorkas has activated a volunteer force to assist Customs and Border Protection. He cites, quote, an overwhelming number of migrants arriving at the border. The migrants making the most news are the unaccompanied children, of course. Anita, what's the latest from the White House?
Yeah, you're right. It's there's a surge, basically, in migrants trying to come over the border. Now, the United States has seen that before, most notably in 2014 when President Biden was then vice president. You know, and right now what's happening, though, is most of those migrants are being turned away. They're adults. And during the coronavirus, there is a restriction on who can come into the country. You've mentioned the children, and that's exactly what the problem is. Right now, or in February, rather, nearly 9,500 unaccompanied children were detained at the border. So that's up from 5,800 the prior month. You can see it's going up, and it should continue to go up in these spring months where the weather is good, because this is it fluctuates depending on the weather. You know, the administration sort of knew this was going to come. They were warned it was going to come. President Trump's Department of Homeland Security had briefed and knew this was going to be coming. So they've put in a number of mechanisms to try to deal with this. Most notably, what they're doing right now is trying to find emergency shelter place across the country to house these children until they can get them into homes of sponsors, generally family members in the country where they can stay. What the Biden administration is doing is different than what President Trump did. President Trump was saying, okay, the children have to go back. What the Biden administration is doing, but is creating a problem, is they're saying for humanitarian reasons, the kids should stay, but then they have to deal with the kids. And that's really what's facing them right now.
I'm Todd Zwillick. This is 1A. Well, David Lightman, Republicans have certainly found a foothold with something based on policy here and not strictly social grievance, not strictly anyway. They're spending a lot of time talking about this crisis at the border, making President Biden own it, which is what you do with presidents. Now, several Republicans are headed to the border themselves, I'm seeing. They're really trying to make a moment out of this.
Oh, yeah. They're convinced that, a couple things. First of all, they feel that the immigration issue has worked well for them going back 10, 15 years. I mean, back to, John McCain, he was trying to forge consensus on this, and you see what happened there. President Trump, from the start, made this a big issue, getting tough on immigration. So they see that as an important way of reaching the public. Minority Leader McCarthy, I think, is going to lead a delegation down there next week. There's a lot of concern that this is an almost not unsolvable issue, but a difficult issue. Henry Cuellar, the congressman from Texas, a Democrat, has said the Biden administration needs to do better messaging, better explanation of all this. So, yeah, Republicans see an opening. The question is just how much the American public is concerned about this, how much this drives their vote. And at the moment, with COVID, with the economy struggling to come back, I'm not sure this is on the top of people's minds, but Republicans do see it that way.
We did talk about the surge of migrants at the border earlier this week, and you can listen back at the 1A.org. Well, Anita, we mentioned comprehensive immigration reform a little earlier in the program. David thought that might be a tipping point for Democrats to change filibuster rules if they want to pass that. I don't know. I see a world where Republicans are doing their best to message against the Biden administration and Democrats on an immigration issue. This doesn't seem like the environment where a comprehensive immigration reform bill that the White House has introduced, how can I say this, really has a prayer as one package anyway.
Well, let's be clear. Even the White House thinks that their comprehensive bill is not going to get through. They talked from the beginning, their Democratic allies talked from the beginning about breaking that large bill up because there's just not an appetite for this huge, huge bill. You know, the last three presidents at least have tried a comprehensive immigration reform bill and all have failed. So they see what's happened before. They don't think that this is going to be any different. What they are hoping to do is break it up into smaller pieces and push it through. Even those, though, I find it hard to believe some will get through. There is some Republican support for it, but is there enough? And will those Republicans actually end up voting for it? You're exactly right, though, on this border issue. What Republicans are doing right now is saying, Joe Biden, you created this mess at the border. That's not exactly true, but they're saying it. And they're saying, why should we you know, why should we, you know, go for another bill or try for this bill when you can't handle it? You caused this problem. So some Democrats hope that people look at the bill and look at the border and say, oh, this is reason we need to get something done. But it might just be Republicans saying, we're going to stand in the way here.
There might be a chance to pass, as Anita says, some smaller immigration proposals, maybe codifying Dreamers or maybe expanding visas. But on the big stuff, pathway to citizenship for 11 million undocumented people in this country, we might not be in a political moment where an agreement like that is anything close to possible. The election's coming up. Are a midterm election. That means fire up your base. Does the Trumpist base want agreement on immigration? Ponder that this weekend. I want to thank my guests for joining us, Anita Kumar, White House correspondent and associate editor with Politico, and David Lightman, congressional correspondent with McClatchy. Thanks to you both. 1A's lead audio engineer and sound designer is Jake Cherry. He gets technical assistance from Ben Privett, Mike Kidd, and Rashad Young. Eileen Humphreys is the producer and editor of 1A On Demand. Gabrielle Healy is our digital editor, and Chris Castano is our digital producer. We'll be back in a moment with the International News Roundup. You're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Kay Buxbaum in support of the David Gilkey and Zabiula Tamana Memorial Fund, established to strengthen NPR's commitment to training and protecting journalists in high-risk environments. Support for NPR comes from Newman's Own Foundation, working to nourish the common good by donating all profits from Newman's Own food products to charitable organizations that seek to make the world a better place. More information is available at newmansownfoundation.org.
And it's that time when we look at the biggest stories from overseas. Italy, which was the first country to impose a national lockdown a year ago, is set for yet another. Elsewhere in Europe, more regulators have suspended the use of the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine. Regulators are looking into reports that it could be linked to blood clots. And China says it's willing to provide vaccines for all athletes competing at the Olympics in Japan this summer, as well as next winter's games in Beijing. Tokyo has said thanks, but no thanks. Our guest this hour, Jennifer Williams, senior foreign editor at Vox. Jennifer, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And David Rennie is here. David is Beijing bureau chief for The Economist. David, as always, great to talk to you.
Hello.
And we welcome back Rosalind Jordan, State Department and special correspondent for Al Jazeera English TV. Rosalind, great to talk to you again.
It's great to be back. Thank you.
Well, let's start with a landmark report from the World Health Organization released on Monday. That was International Women's Day. The numbers are stark, and they drew some attention again on how many women around the world experience physical or sexual violence at least once in their lifetime. Rosalind, what were the top lines of this report?
Well, according to this new report from WHO, globally, about one in three women, or about 30%, and I'm quoting here, have been subjected to either physical or sexual intimate partner violence or non-partner sexual violence in their lifetime. That's one in three women, according to the WHO. It also says that much of this violence is intimate partner violence, something which domestic violence experts here in the U.S. and around the world will tell you that people are most at risk by suffering this sort of violence at the hands of those they love and who purportedly say they love them. Also, quoting from the report, this violence can negatively affect women's physical, mental, sexual, and reproductive health. It may also increase the risk of these women acquiring HIV in some settings. It does go on to stress, however, that this violence is preventable, and it says that the global health sector has a key role in screening for people's being abused, trying to help them get into situations where they are safe, and really trying to get them to the other support services, particularly in the justice system, that can help protect women from this kind of violence. Of course, we all are looking at this report in light of the case of Sarah Everard. She's the London woman who was found murdered this week, and a Metropolitan police officer has been arrested suspected of having killed her. And it's really set off a firestorm in the UK. So many people have said, I've been sexually harassed, minding my own business. I've been sexually harassed or menaced while at work or while at the gym or while at the shopping center. You know, you basically can't walk out your front door without someone violating your space. And while the number of cases of women being sexually harmed or being murdered is lower than it is here in the United States, it really has set off a firestorm there about why men can't keep themselves to themselves.
It's worth pointing out as we look at these extremely important and unjust statistics from the WHO that it only accounts for 2000 to 2018, which means it does not account for the impact of the past year of the pandemic and people being locked down at home, which in many ways can exacerbate domestic violence, partner violence. Well, speaking on Monday, New Zealand's prime minister said that domestic violence should be seen as a shadow pandemic.
Along with being directly affected by the virus itself and its immediate impacts on our livelihoods, we're also the subjects of intensified domestic violence. Only by fully and meaningfully including women and girls in leadership and decision-making at all levels can we ensure that our responses to the pandemic meet the needs of everyone.
Jennifer Williams with Vox. Roslyn points out that the WHO report says that governments really can exact policies that help alleviate this horrible problem. There is something governments can do. Are there signs that governments are willing to accept more responsibility and that they have agency in this problem?
In many cases, yes, there is a growing awareness, I think, of the kind of, you know, really endemic situation that you have facing women and girls around the world. I think the question is less one of willingness, though there is certainly an issue there in many places. A lot of it also just has to do with capacity and just understanding of how to address such a complex problem, right? This isn't just a kind of one-size-fits-all solution that you can just put a Band-Aid on this, right? There are socioeconomic factors, demographic factors, you know, cultural issues, everything from education, from, you know, economic problems that you see that all factor into this. It makes it a complex problem to address and then really needs to involve everything from, you know, mental health professionals to healthcare professionals to, you know, serious economic policy, right? We see in times, and particularly in times of economic crisis in a lot of places in the world, we see families marrying off their young girls to often much, much older men. And partly this is because they see that they can't, you know, feed and clothe and support their children. And so the idea is to, you know, hopefully give them a better opportunity. And yet they end up often getting trapped in these abusive, you know, horrific relationships. I think the point about this data not reflecting the pandemic is a really important one that we shouldn't gloss over. You know, it's really difficult because lockdowns, which are so incredibly important for addressing the pandemic, also mean in many cases that women and girls are trapped with their abusers at home, and they're limited in terms of the places they can go and the people they interact with to ask for help, to communicate to professionals who are trained to look for those signs. And so I think we have to realize that, you know, while we are addressing one pandemic, as Jacinda Ardern said, there is another shadow pandemic happening. So I think it's really important that healthcare professionals and anyone who interacts with women and girls in these situations makes sure that they're being extra vigilant to look for signs and to give people opportunities to ask for help and get the help they need.
David Rennie, it was in Beijing in 1995 that Hillary Clinton famously now declared women's rights are human rights. Now, China passed a law on domestic violence 5 years ago. Is this an issue that is being talked about a lot in China? Is the Chinese Communist Party and the government taking it seriously?
It does come up. Unfortunately, it comes up usually when that law that you mentioned, which was passed in 2015, isn't used properly, because there's a tension between there are people in the system who understand that, like many countries, they have a big problem with domestic violence. But the government is also extremely concerned about keeping families intact. They're worried about a falling birth rate. There's a socially conservative side to the Chinese Communist Party that has become more marked under the current leader, Xi Jinping. And so you've seen some cases that became very big sort of topics of public debate here, where, for example, women went to try and get a divorce, saying that their husbands were committing domestic violence. There was a lot of evidence, police evidence, hospital evidence. And the judge said, no, I don't think that you should be getting divorced. I think you need to make a go of this marriage, or maybe those injuries aren't so severe. And in a couple of tragic cases, the women were then later murdered by those same abusive husbands. And that did become a debate about whether the kind of the idea of social stability that's so dear to the party is in tension with their avowed attempts to try and protect women from domestic violence. But that the laws exist, they're not currently being used as activists had hoped.
Rosalind, what about American leadership on this issue of violence against women and girls and domestic violence worldwide? What has it been like the last 4 years, if you like, and where is it now?
Well, perhaps most notably or infamously, the 1995 Violence Against Women Act, which then Senator Joe Biden championed and pushed through to become law, expired during the Trump administration. And what that meant was a real loss in terms of federal policy and federal funding for programs to help screen for domestic violence, to help people who are victims of domestic violence get the legal support, get the psychological support, get the economic support they need to leave their abusers and to live in safety. Now, current President Biden is now pushing to have this legislation reauthorized, but you know, who knows how quickly that can happen. You've also seen an administration that is prioritizing the safety, the education, the welfare of women and girls around the world. We have heard this from the new Secretary of State, Antony Blinken. We are seeing this in a number of policies that are being pushed across the federal government. But it's still early days in terms of how the Biden administration can actually stand up and be a champion for the rights of women and girls around the world. It is also worth pointing out that in Congress, there is an effort, and I'm not sure how successful it will be, to overturn the Hyde Amendment, which essentially bans the U.S. from supporting any family planning programs that include abortion around the world. And that policy has been in effect for more than 30 years. But there are some members of the House of Representatives who are reintroducing legislation, and they say that their ultimate goal is to overturn Hyde. So it's early days. It may not be successful, but, you know, because there is a very, very strong anti-abortion component in the political sphere here in the United States. And so there, I think the battle will be joined.
Well, Ian Maxwell says that his sister, Ghislaine Maxwell, the former girlfriend of Jeffrey Epstein, who's in prison here in the United States, should be allowed out on bail. This week, he told the BBC the conditions that she's being kept under in New York are barbaric and that they amount to torture.
No human being should have to go through what she's being put through. It is really degrading. And in terms of the deprivation of sleep, this is not the way that a democratic country should be running its prison system. It's grotesque. And in that respect, it amounts to torture. So, yes, I am worried about Ghislaine's capacity to endure much more of this treatment.
Jennifer, given what became of Jeffrey Epstein before he was due to go on trial, what impact do you think that there might be on how authorities view Ghislaine Maxwell's safety here?
Right. That's definitely kind of a top of mind of what's going on. As you know, listeners may remember, Jeffrey Epstein died by suicide in prison in 2019, you know, while he was due to go on trial. And, you know, so that's definitely something that is clearly a factor here. She is being basically observed 24 hours a day. According to her brother, there are, you know, as many as 10 cameras watching her every move. You know, he says she's being held basically in effective isolation and has been so for nearly 250 days. I think it's also not just about that, but also about the potential flight risk here.
Right.
You know, Ghislaine Maxwell is a U.S., U.K., and French citizen. She has citizenship in three countries. She has passports that allow her to travel. She has incredible means to travel, meaning she's extremely wealthy. She has mansions in several countries. And, you know, they had a hard time finding her for quite a while and were looking for her. And I think that's certainly something that the prosecutors have been arguing. She is actually currently seeking bail ahead of her trial in July, and two previous applications for bail were denied, basically citing that she's a plain risk of flight. You know, I think it's also important to understand that, you know, certainly prison conditions in the United States are something that need to be addressed very seriously. At the same time, you also need to understand that this is coming in the context of, you know, an extremely wealthy, privileged woman who finds herself now in a position that, you know, many, many people of much less means often find themselves in jail. I assume that she probably does find it incredibly degrading. I personally haven't investigated what the conditions are like. I haven't visited her in prison and don't intend to. But, you know, I think it's important to kind of see that in the context as well as they're trying to get bail for her. But I think it's also really important to understand that some of the terms that are being used, degrading, are also very easily applied to the behavior she is, you know, being accused of having inflicted on these young women and girls that she is accused of having trafficked, you know, girls as young as 14 to have sex with wealthy and powerful men. So, you know, not to say that anyone, of course, deserves to be treated, in an inappropriate or unlawful way in prison. But it is also a bit hard, I think, to have empathy as a human, and for me as a woman, for, you know, an extremely wealthy woman to complain that her food tastes like it's, you know, being microwaved, given the kind of enormity of her crimes, allegedly.
Well, Ghislaine Maxwell's lawyers have said she's willing to relinquish her citizenship in France and the UK. Prosecutors, as you said, say she is a flight risk. And as a reminder, we will point out, a court has not found Ghislaine Maxwell guilty. She remains innocent until proven so as she awaits trial in prison now. I want to take us to Brazil, however, where COVID-19 infection rates are soaring once again. This country has exceeded 2,000 daily deaths due to COVID. Its healthcare system is overwhelmed. Brazil has the second most deaths in the entire world, second, by the way, to the United States. Jennifer, let me stick with you. What's happening in Brazil?
Sure. So it's getting really bad. It's been pretty bad the entire time. Around 300,000 people have already died from COVID in Brazil so far. At this point, the occupancy of ICU beds is above 90% in 15 out of 27 state capitals in the country. Part of that spread is thought to be partly due to the new variant, the P1 variant that has emerged in Brazil. But it's also very much due to the abject failure of Jair Bolsonaro, the president, to do anything to combat the virus. He has been a COVID denier the entire time. He has pushed junk science cures, spent lots of money on, you know, acquiring hydroxychloroquine, even though it had been, you know, shown not to be effective and potentially dangerous at treating COVID. He was very slow to even start negotiating vaccines for his country. Now that he has done so, he is very much saying that, you know, he's pushing dangerous conspiracy theories and bad science, saying that they're unsafe, saying just really wild stuff. I mean, at one point he said, look, you know, you're welcome to take it if you want. I'm not going to take the vaccine, and it's not going to be my fault if you turn into a crocodile or if women start growing beards. Those are actual things that he said.
You hear those things and you want to laugh because it's quippy. On the other hand, it is just astoundingly irresponsible and criminal against the good health of people listening to a president say that. David, Brazil's president Jair Bolsonaro has taken a lot of criticism for his handling of the coronavirus pandemic. Among his most vocal critics has been the former president, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, a veteran left-leaning politician. But now that Brazilian courts have dropped corruption charges against him, Lula has made it clear that the fight is back on. He's getting back into the fray. His return is big news. Can you remind us who exactly he is and why his return to the stage in Brazil matters so much?
So in his day, Lula was this extraordinarily charismatic former car worker, rose up through the trade union movement, became this incredibly dynamic kind of rags-to-riches success story in this very divided country. And he was his fall from grace is a result of this gigantic corruption investigation known as Lava Jato, or the car wash anti-corruption task force, which was all about a gigantic scheme where a very wealthy construction company was accused of bribing the country's top politicians to get public contracts. And Lula was sentenced to 12 years in jail and served 580 days in jail. He was finally released, but still considered guilty. And this then became immensely political because the judge who had helped to put Lula away then became the justice minister in Bolsonaro's government. Tapes emerged that judge had been coaching witnesses. And so Lula and his supporters would like to have the entire conviction, the entire investigation quashed as a kind of political witch hunt. For the moment, what's just happened is that his convictions have been annulled on a really technical ground to do with that they were filed in the wrong jurisdiction. But what that means is that just as Bolsonaro's popularity is finally tanking after remarkable success despite the COVID-19 sort of tragedy in Brazil, finally, partly because some welfare payments that Bolsonaro used at the beginning of the pandemic to retain his popularity, those have run out, and the money generally is running out, and you now have 75-year-old Lula back from utter disgrace, saying he has the energy of a 30-year-old, landing real punches on Bolsonaro's lack of economic success and his callous handling of COVID. And you can see this incredibly divided country. There was an amazingly interesting poll this week that 50% of Brazilians said they could imagine voting for Lula again. 44% they said they could never imagine voting for Lula again. But those numbers are better than Bolsonaro's. Bolsonaro currently has 56% of Brazilians say they can't imagine voting for him again. And Bolsonaro, who was the outsider populist last time, is also involved in corruption scandals. So you shouldn't envy Brazilian voters. They don't have fantastic choices. But this 75-year-old firebrand leftist is back from the kind of political death. And it's an extraordinary drama.
The energy of a 30-year-old, you say, that's quite a statement for a man of 75 coming back into the scene. Brazilians might hold him to it. Well, I want to have a good discussion about China because there's a lot of important news, as always, between China and the United States. U.S. lawmakers were told this week, gang, that China could invade Taiwan within the next 6 years as Beijing accelerates its moves to supplant American military power in the South China Sea and in Asia. Now, that warning came from Washington's top military officer in the Asia Pacific, Admiral Philip Davidson. Listen.
I worry that they're accelerating their ambitions to supplant the United States and our leadership role in the rules-based international order, which they've long said that they want to do that by 2050. I'm worried about them moving that target closer. Taiwan is clearly one of their ambitions before then, and I think the threat is manifest during this decade, in fact, in the next 6 years.
Rosalind Jordan, you've spent an awful lot of time at the State Department. I heard these statements from the military brass. I get it, and I take them to heart. It makes me wonder if this is one of those moments in diplomacy where the Pentagon says, threat, 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 get us into the South China Sea more aggressively, and the State Department, the diplomats say, hang on, this can be solved diplomatically. Let's not push further into a confrontation. Do I have that right, or are the dynamics different here?
The dynamics are very different, and it comes because there is a new administration. I had a very informative interview with Danny Russell, the former Assistant Secretary of State for East Asia Pacific Affairs, this week. And he said that what is really notable about not just the Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, meeting with his Chinese counterparts this coming week in Anchorage, Alaska, it's that he's doing this after having two strategic dialogues with his defense counterpart, Lloyd Austin, in Tokyo and in Seoul. And so what former Assistant Secretary Russell suggested is that they are going to be going to this meeting in Anchorage with a very visible message, 2 days of high-level diplomatic and military consultations with treaty allies, Japan and South Korea, underscoring the fact that the U.S. is not abandoning the Pacific Rim, is certainly not going to do so, to Beijing, and that the promises from candidate Joe Biden and now President Joe Biden that the U.S. is going to be very much challenging and confronting Beijing in all spheres of society, in order to check what it considers Beijing's untoward and possibly illegal behavior in some realms. That is the message that is being underscored. That is the message that Blinken and the National Security Advisor, Jake Sullivan, will be taking to their meeting in Anchorage. One thing that we have seen consistently since Joe Biden took office a little more than 2 months ago is that the U.S. does consider China to be its premier global rival.
Rosalind, so often when we look at this relationship as you're describing, we look toward Taiwan, which is one of many, but one of the major pressure points between the United States and China. So as the United States enters these talks with the National Security Advisor, the Secretary of State, with their counterparts in Alaska, as you described, how important is Taiwan now in the overall picture? You said the United States does view China as its major rival in economics, in military affairs, in human rights.
It's very, very important. I mean, one of the symbols of how important Taiwan is to this administration is that the de facto ambassador to the United States was invited to Joe Biden's inauguration. And that is something that did not sit well with the Chinese. What also was quite notable is that the U.S. has not tried to roll back the late session arms deal that the Trump administration made with Taipei. And that was something else that really angered Beijing. And really what we're expecting to see in this first face-to-face meeting of foreign policy senior officials from both governments is not just tough talk, but an initial set of expectations and criticisms coming from the United States. There's also the expectation that they will be listening to see what kinds of messages Beijing is sending in order to not feel so much of Washington's wrath, as it were. But there is this consistent message that Taiwan is important, that Taiwan is its own entity, and they have to walk that line very, very carefully for legal reasons. There is this sense that China cannot just abscond with taking over international waterways for its own use, as it has been trying to do in the South China Sea. It cannot get away with trying to build up its military and to use that military to essentially bully its way around East Asia and possibly into South Asia as well. We should point out that this is a concern of Indian security officials.
As we're talking about pressure points on China, China's treatment of the Uyghurs has, of course, become all too late an issue of growing international concern. China's foreign minister said those claiming the country was engaged in a genocide of the Uyghurs was absurd. But pressure is building here in the United States to boycott the Winter Games in Beijing next year. This is Florida Republican Michael Watts speaking to CBN earlier this week.
Now we have mounting evidence of an ongoing genocide, with the Uyghur Muslims in Western China being sent to concentration camps, a mass campaign of sterilization for Uyghur women. How can we give them that global platform to whitewash everything they're doing? I'd argue that we can't. And we're calling on the U.S. Olympic Committee and calling on the Biden administration to pull our athletes back at this point.
David, talk about the building pressure on the Olympics and a potential American boycott.
You can see this here in Beijing. Every time we get a readout of a phone call between Chinese leaders and leaders in, you know, Europe, for example, almost invariably they make a point that the European foreign minister or whoever it is says how much they're looking forward to sending their athletes to the Winter Olympics. They're extremely sensitive about this. Remember, they were that the 2008 Summer Olympics in Beijing was a real coming out party for the kind of the rich, new, confident China. The Winter Olympics is less important, but still, you know, a big, big deal for them. It's about a year away now, just under a year away. And they are concerned about talk of a boycott. To be honest, I don't think there's going to be a boycott. I think if you talk to diplomats, they talk about maybe kind of reining in some of the presence, but people still want to send their athletes. I'd personally be very surprised if there's a boycott.
Jennifer Williams, I want to return us to China, because when we got into the discussion about a potential American boycott of the Olympics, which David Rennie says he does not expect, it's over the treatment and the persecution of Uyghur Muslims in Western China. There's this debate over the term genocide, whether it should be applied here, whether it really applies. Now, genocide, of course, refers to the destruction of a people, a nation or an ethnic group. Is that what's going on here? Is it really genocide? Is the choice of that word important here?
The choice of the word is incredibly important for particularly diplomatic and for international legal reasons. I think one of the things that gets kind of obscured in conversations about genocide is that because of the way it's, you know, been applied previously, we tend to think of that it means also just like mass murder, right? When we talk about internment camps, we obviously think about the Nazis and their war crimes and the genocide against, you know, the Holocaust against the Jews and others. But genocide also includes a component of cultural destruction. So it doesn't have to be just mass murder. It doesn't have to be the physical obliteration of a people. It can also be the systematic destruction of their culture, of who they are as a people.
Why is ethnic cleansing an insufficient term then?
Right. Ethnic cleansing was very much become and initially kind of conceived as a bit of a euphemism to make it sound a little less kind of serious as genocide. Ethnic cleansing, to me, it sounds like they're just cleaning house, which is, you know, a horrific way of thinking about how to treat human beings. But it also very much referred to it in many cases, forcible transfer of populations from physical territories. So trying to get groups of people out of a particular region and move them into another region. Often here, what you're seeing in Xinjiang is very much a concerted effort to destroy the Uyghur as a culture, right? As a religious and ethnic and cultural identity. So, you know, very much in terms of, you know, sending Han Chinese men to live with Uyghur women and, you know, having them, you know, forced sterilization to end, you know, the further births, yes, as a physical population, but also these re-education efforts, as they call them, in these camps that are meant to basically stamp out all expressions of Muslim religious identity, of Uyghur cultural, linguistic, everything identity, and to make them into basically, you know, traditionally patriotic Chinese citizens. And so I think, you know, when it comes to the use of the term genocide, it also becomes a challenge once you have used that label, though, right? Because now that the Biden administration and like the Trump administration did before them has applied that label, well, the question then becomes, well, how do you deal with a regime that you have just accused of one of the single, you know, most horrific crimes that a government can perpetrate against a people? And it becomes a huge kind of, not a speed bump, but a big kind of roadblock in diplomacy in some ways. And so that's why some people have been concerned about the application of this term. I personally think it is appropriate to use. I don't think it serves any purposes to kind of whitewash or undercut the gravity and the enormity of the abuses that are going on here. But again, I think you need to talk about what the use of that term means. Also, in international law, there are very specific kind of legal, you know, metrics you have to hit to reach that bar. But, you know, it's not like anyone's expecting to see Xi Jinping before the International Criminal Court here. So right. It's very much being used in a diplomatic sense right now.
And important to think through the consequences of using that language, which on the diplomatic stage, as you say, carries an enormous amount of weight in meaning. Well, David, Jennifer refers to President Xi. He's not going to be in the International Criminal Court anytime soon. He is trying to do something of a dance with his own domestic situation in China. You've been writing about this in The Economist. This is called red tourism. And this is President Xi trying to deal with some of the troubling aspects of his own country's past. Tell me a little bit about red tourism.
So it's been going on for some years, but we're going to see a real peak of talking about the Communist Party's history this year, because it's the 100th centenary of the founding of the Communist Party of China in July, which is going to be a very, very big deal. One of the really interesting changes that Xi Jinping has made compared to some of his big predecessors is that you had the biggest leader post-Chairman Mao was willing to talk openly about the worst mistakes and crimes committed under Mao because he wanted to try and break away from some of those really extreme economic and ideological policies. And so Deng Xiaoping, the great paramount leader, was willing to actually be quite candid about some of the big mistakes the party made. Xi Jinping, since he became the big leader in 2012, has made very clear that he thinks that's a mistake. And in fact, he's talked about how the Soviet Union, in his view, one of the reasons it collapsed was that it repudiated Stalin. And once they'd done that, they had kind of broken the idea that the Communist Party was always right under all circumstances. And he talks about historical nihilism. As a historian in China or a writer, you could actually be prosecuted for talking about past crimes under the Chinese Communist Party. There's this idea that the party may have taken some wrong turns, but it was always the right party to believe in. Part of that is you're seeing a tremendous push to send hundreds of millions of Chinese to take tourist holidays to revolutionary sites, a lot of them to do with the civil war against the nationalists and the war against the Japanese. And you'll literally go to some of these sites and see, you know, dozens of, you know, sort of fairly portly middle-aged Chinese officials dressed in kind of play uniforms as if they're Red Army soldiers from the 1930s and 1940s and kind of walking around these sites, partly a holiday, partly a kind of patriotism thing. But it's absolutely intended to spread the message that the Communist Party of today is the best of all possible governments, and look at the success of its economic policies and everything else. And it's only because the people of China kept faith with them throughout all of their different twists and turns, including the worst excesses of the Mao years, that we're now lucky enough to have them around today. And so it's a gigantic propaganda push and a totally different vision of what history is for. You know, in the West, it's a debate about what's the truth. In China, it's a tool to help people understand the majesty of the Communist Party of China.
China has landed a couple of very impressive unmanned probes on the far side of the moon, a couple of really nice lunar descents and landings. Now they're saying that they're teaming up with the Russians for a future human moon base, not teaming up with the United States. What's behind this decision?
So after a long time of kind of quiet on the moon, it's kind of rush hour. So the Americans have a plan that's, you know, they're doing this with the Europeans, with the British, with a total of 8 countries have this scheme called the Artemis Accords, which is going to build this lunar gateway to try and put people back on the surface of the moon. You're going to have the first lunar landings, US ones, in 2024. The Russians, because of all the other political difficulties they have with the Americans, although they cooperate on things like rockets and supplying sort of space stations, they decided not to join this NASA-led lunar program, and they have now signed a memorandum with the Chinese to build what will initially be a robot base at the lunar South Pole. But the idea is to put first some short-term crews and then some long-term human presence at the South Pole of the moon, led by the Russians and the Chinese, as soon as 2036. So this is a, you know, it's a really extraordinary return of, you know, just in case you thought everything else about the Cold War was sort of suddenly very familiar, we're back into kind of space races and putting boots on the moon. And this is a huge prestige thing in China. If you go around a propaganda exhibition here, you know, the first thing you will see is a model of a space rocket, pictures of Chinese taikonauts, which is what they call them here, astronauts, cosmonauts for the Soviets, and taikonauts here. And it's a big deal. And, you know, they've done some impressive things. They have some lunar landers picking up soil and bringing it back to Earth.
I want to make sure we hit one quick point here just for a second. They're not fixing to try to beat the U.S. back to the moon with crewed missions. That's going to be us. We're going to win that race for the second time.
if that's how you want to pitch it. Yes, there will be a Stars and Stripes landing on the moon in 2024, we believe. And in fact, the Americans are saying it's going to be one of the first women on the moon. Will also be 2024, and that's part of the Artemis program. But the Russians and the Chinese are building this fairly substantial base at the South Pole, and they're talking about putting people there for years at a time after 2036.
Artemis is the twin sister of Apollo, and it will put an American woman on the moon. Rosalind Jordan, there's unrest in Dakar, the capital of Senegal. Protesters out in the streets, some of them killed by authorities. Can you please bring us up to speed on the situation in Senegal?
Well, back on March 3rd, an opposition politician named Ousmane Sonko was arrested and charged with rape. He's very popular in particular with young Senegalese who have become very disenchanted with the president, Macky Sall. Macky Sall came to power last decade promising jobs, education, opportunity for an overwhelmingly young population in a country that still has very close ties to France. Well, of course, Macky Sall has not delivered, and so the unrest with him was, you know, pretty much predictable. At least 5 people, according to the central government, have been killed. Human rights organizations say that the figure may be considerably higher. There was a day of mourning that was called for this week, But again, there are protests being scheduled for this weekend, not just against the Saul government, but also against French businesses and French governmental organizations, which they believe have been hampering Senegal's efforts to modernize and to raise the standard of living in that West African country. It's really a significant moment because you have not seen protest and police violence of this sort in this country in many, many years. And it's, you know, it's in fact one of Al Jazeera's lead stories for the past couple of weeks because it is so unusual because Macky Sall was elected with so much popularity. But now because of the arrest and the charging of Sonko, you know, you really are seeing what could be a transformation in the body politic, but it's not going to be resolved anytime soon.
And Jennifer, as Rosalind says, Senegal is a country that's enjoyed decades of relative stability in that region. Even while, you know, next door in Mali, there were Al-Qaeda insurgencies in the north, even while Mauritania experienced a civil unrest, Senegal's been relatively stable.
Yeah, it has. And that's why, you know, this is getting so much attention, I think. I think there's one thing that's really important to kind of note here. You know, we opened the show by talking about violence against women and girls. And I think there's an interesting component here that it's important not to overlook. And that's the fact that Sonko was accused of rape. These are very serious charges by a beauty salon employee. She has since gone into hiding. Now, they're, you know, are obviously very serious accusations that this is political, that these are trumped up charges. But I think it's also important not to overlook that women's groups in the country are speaking out and saying, look, you know, it is not okay to use women as a political tool in your fighting between opposition leaders, you know, the opposition leaders and the president, right? And I think, again, I think this kind of comes back to that conversation we had at the beginning, which is that, you know, women and their bodies and, you know, violence against women and violations of women are very much at the center of a lot of things and are being exploited potentially in this case, right? This is a very much a serious rape charge. And so I think it's important not to just completely overlook that fact here.
I want to thank our guests for this hour and this week. That was Jennifer Williams, senior foreign editor at Vox. Jennifer, thank you for the perspective on Senegal and on the WHO report in China that you delivered. I appreciate it. David Rennie stayed up very late for us in Beijing. He's Beijing bureau chief for The Economist, and Rosalind Jordan from Al Jazeera. Thanks to you all. 1A's managing producer is Paige Osborne. Jake Cherry is our sound designer and engineer. Barb Anguiano produces our podcast. This program comes to you from WAMU. It's part of American University in Washington. It's distributed by NPR. I'm Todd Zwillick. Jen White is back on Monday. Have a great weekend. This is 1A.